Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said so. But I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" They answered, "He deserves death." Then they spat in his face and struck him. And some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?"
And I think that passage goes to the heart of our attitude to God. In some songs, in some popular ideas, in films and books, there's this thought, what if God were one of us? What if God came down and lived as one of us? Of course, we think about this at Christmas time. But what would he be like? How would he cope? What would we be like with him? And the answer this passage gives, and it's not alone, is we'd abuse and kill him. If we had half the chance, we would kill God. In fact, some more aggressively atheist novels and the films that come out of them follow that very idea, that very theme. Not long ago, Stephen Fry, well-known comedian, writer, and atheist, an interviewer said to him, "What if you were wrong? What if after, you know, you assume that you die and it's oblivion, but what if you, after you die, you assume that you were wrong? And you met God? What would you say?" And his answer was, "How dare you?" And had a list of accusations against God. Now, apart from the logical, the number of logical fallacies that carries with it, another comedian said, "Well, that's probably not the time to make a stand." Now, he was making a joke, but a very valid insight as he did so. But that attitude that we find is not a new one. And we see it again in this encounter, this trial. What we've been seeing over this term as we go through Matthew 26, and we'll go right through by Easter to the end, we see that Jesus is willingly taking himself to the cross. And we see it again here today as we come to the table. We see how Jesus willingly goes to the cross. Christ offers himself for us and invites us to come. Now what we're going to do now is focus on the key characters just in this section. So it's Caiaphas and Sanhedrin, Peter, the others that are mentioned, and Christ himself. So firstly we've got Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. But particularly want to think of Caiaphas. Notice the identity, particularly Caiaphas' identity. He is the high priest. That is, he has the highest religious office there could be. This is passed down from Aaron. He's not just a Levite, he's not just a priest, he's the high priest, a descendant of Aaron. It's dignified, it's an essential religious function. You need a high priest in order to come to God. In fact, one of the functions of the high priest is to point us to the Christ, to point us to Jesus Christ who is to come. And yet, Caiaphas epitomizes the Antichrist sentiments in this chapter. And I think there's a warning here about position and office. They by themselves are no certainty of faithfulness. Already we've seen that in this chapter, haven't we? It's been repeated, in fact. Judas, one of the twelve. And now Caiaphas, the high priest. Often, if it's happened to you, it's happened to me a number of times, you have a conversation with someone about the gospel and about the Bible, and they go, "Ah, yeah, but so-and-so, who's a theologian, and you're not really a proper theologian, are you? And they went to a famous university, and they think such and such, and this guy's a bishop, and he doesn't agree with that, or he's a minister of a really big church. What does that mean to God? Zip. It means nothing. They're secure in their own position, but it means nothing. Having an office, meeting someone who's in a high office, it's of no significance at all, because it'll be swept away. Significant to them, they're more accountable. But to us, it means nothing. And if you are someone who holds an office, then, well, it doesn't mean that you're right. It doesn't mean you're automatically more faithful. Also, the identity of what we keep seeing in this chapter is that all abandon Jesus. All abandon Jesus. The high priest and the Sanhedrin now are abandoning Jesus. Now, as I was preparing this, I was reading a few books and written by experts. Some experts are very nervous when they get to bits like this in the Gospels, because it sounds a bit anti-Jewish. Is Matthew having a go at the Jews? Now, apparently, Matthew is writing primarily to a Jewish audience. And it's true that, sadly, in history, passages like this have been used against Jews. A sort of, look at what they did to Jesus. But as we've gone through this section, we've noticed already there's no room for saying, oh, poor Jesus, look at what's happening to poor Jesus. He's in control. He's in control of all of these events. And also, as we've been reading through all of Matthew, as we have done over the last few years, we see that the conflict that keeps on coming up is between Jesus and the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees were religious conservatives. People often say they're ones who are a bit like us, a bit like evangelicals. They were a popular movement, but, much like evangelicals, they had absolutely no say in anything. They had no say even in the church, so to speak, in the people of God, no political authority. People respected them, but they had no say in what went on. That was in the temple. The power in the temple was controlled by the Sanhedrin, who were mostly Sadducees. So the Pharisees and Sadducees, they didn't think much of each other. The Pharisees, like I said, a bit like us, they believed in all of the Old Testament, all of the Bible as they had it. They believed in the supernatural. They believed in angels. They believed in the resurrection of the dead. The Sanhedrins believed in the first five books of the Bible very narrowly. They were moral conservatives, traditionalists, but that was it. Not supernaturalists and so on. So we've seen the conflict with the Pharisees all the way through. We haven't heard much of the Sadducees. Now the conflict is with the Sadducees. A different group, still Jewish, but a different group that Jesus now is in conflict with. We've already had the 12 left him. And in the next couple of weeks, like spoiler alert, we'll have the trial with Pilate. He's a Roman Gentile, like us. We're not Roman, but we're Gentile. Herod, who's a Middle Eastern Gentile. So the point is, all have abandoned Jesus. Jews and Gentiles, those close to him, far, religious conservatives, religious relativists, they all have abandoned Jesus. Not just Jews, but all. I think the reason why we get more airtime for the Jews is the emphasis, even his own, even those closest to him, have abandoned him. And we see more about the others who do as well, the false witnesses used by the Sadducees and Sanhedrin, and all the injustice that comes up with it. Also, he's the high priest. What is the high priest's role? Is to offer the sacrificial lamb. The high priest has a key role in worship. He offers the sacrifices, including the lamb. He's the one who leads the Day of Atonement, who stands before the people and God. And here, Caiaphas acts better than he knows. Now, John's Gospel picks this up in a different way. Caiaphas there states that it's better for one man to die than for the people. And the point that Caiaphas is making is, it's better to execute Jesus under slightly dubious circumstances in a slightly questionable manner than the Romans come and smash up our privileged position. But he speaks better than he knows, because in fact that is what happens, that Jesus does die to save many, but not in the way Caiaphas meant it. And here he does the same. He is sending Jesus to the cross. He's trumped up charges to get rid of someone he thinks is a pain. But he serves Jesus' purposes, that he offer himself as the perfect sacrificial lamb. And who does it? The high priest. The high priest offers up the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Now, when you take that all together, the the functions of his identity and put that together, we see it again, this fulfillment that we keep on seeing, that they all hand Jesus over, they all abandon him, and despite their position, all the groups turn on Jesus. It looks pretty grim, but in doing so, they're fulfilling the Old Testament, all the different types and sacrifices, even the injustices do that. And in verse 67, there's this false accusation of blasphemy. Of course, it's far from it, because Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is the God-man. How can he blaspheme by correctly identifying himself? But see, what Caiaphas is doing by calling it blasphemy. He's imputing guilt. He's considering guilt onto Jesus that's not his. He's considering the innocent guilty. And that's exactly what we've been thinking about in the evenings as we've gone through Romans 3 and 4. So all the way through, we see Jesus' sovereign control. He's in charge of the events which all lead to your salvation. You can trust him with it. Let's see what Peter does. There's lots about Peter in this chapter. He keeps popping up, incidentally. And most of us like Peter. We say, well, I can relate to him. And I think we're meant to here is we have this progression of swear, sleep, sword, sneaks, and I can't think of anything with S as he abandons. He swears. He says, I swear I will not leave you. I will die for you. We saw that a few weeks ago. And then the following week we saw he's having gone, oh, I'm going to willing to die for you. He sleeps in Gethsemane. He can't stay awake to pray. Then we saw him last week swinging his sword around, which was the wrong thing to do. He's meant to trust and pray, but instead he intervenes and starts trying to win battles for Jesus. And here we now see him sneaking around at a distance. He doesn't want to leave Jesus, but he can't identify with Jesus. And we'll see more next week as he abandons him entirely. Now, I think we can relate to that because, and what we've seen each time Peter comes up, the issue with Peter is not a matter of bravery, that's not the issue, but shame. Following Jesus is following the shame of the cross and failure. You've got to be willing to be considered a failure. And sometimes we want to avoid that. We don't mind people thinking we're brave, but we don't like people thinking we're a failure. And it's a warning here that even at the best, even Peter, but I don't think in chapter 26, as we see even Peter do this, we're meant to beat ourselves up. I think the point is there are no heroes at the cross. There are no heroes. Only Jesus can do this. Ultimately, it is Jesus does this. He does it alone. And he does so for us. There's some other people as well. I just want to group together. Various others in the passage. They all act in injustice towards Jesus, unfairness and disdain. Now, on the one hand, if you notice that they follow the law, they need a minimum of two witnesses. So most legal systems, you need a minimum of two witnesses to carry a conviction. But everything else is wrong. It's at night. Jewish law was court cases have to be during the day. They're meant to be over 2 days. And it's meant to be this not particularly radical idea to us of a defense as well. It's not a fair trial. It's all done so that there can be no questions asked. And the witnesses are false. And so in verse 66, they pass judgment on him to kill him. Verse 67 to 68, they spat, they hit, they mocked. They're mocking him for his lack of knowledge and power. What can you do about this? What do you know about this? Now you have to at this point see the irony of what we already know about Jesus. That they pass judgment on who? The judge of the universe. They are judging their judge. They mock and spit on the king of the universe. They mock his lack of knowledge and power on the one who knows all things and has all power. And as we've gone through this section, we see they come with clubs and swords in a mob to the one who can command legions of angels, but also is the one who goes willingly. So on both accounts, the weapons were irrelevant. And it had to be so, because there'd be nothing they could do about it otherwise. If Jesus said, yeah, I'm not on board with this, there's nothing they could do to stop him. It's hard not to notice that the evidence is all trumped up, isn't it? Have you noticed that before? If someone has made up their mind about something, the last thing they need is evidence. Have you come across that before? A willingness to believe anyone if you already think something. No matter how dishonest or unreliable the witnesses might be, whatever chain of email correspondence and other weaknesses you might have to say otherwise. Or the other way around, a refusal to believe if you disagree with that, no matter how reliable and honest the person is. You get this all the time on TV and in the papers with politicians. If there's a politician that the newspaper or you don't like, you do not hear anything good that they do, and you believe all the bad news about them, and the reverse for the ones that you like. And just something I've noticed with people is, despite what they say, they do not go with the evidence leads. They go with what they already think. And we find that with Jesus. And this is what we do for them once a term and other events that we do, Christianity Explored and things like it. That people, of course, some people won't go if you invite them. Why would they have to go? Because they don't need the facts. They've already got them. Because they watched a documentary 5 years ago. Why would they need facts? Some might come to catch me out, which we welcome. And it is me that gets the red face, not you. Some do actually want to find out, don't they? Some do want to find out. And part of what we're doing is eliminating excuses and equipping ourselves. But people often have made up their mind already about Jesus. They say, well, there's no evidence. And you go, apart from this. And they go, well, you know, you would say that. They use some kind of twisty logic to avoid the conclusions of where it would go. Bertrand Russell, a famous atheistic philosopher, said this, part of a wider thing he was saying about why he can't be a Christian. He said, religion is based primarily on fear. It is partly the terror of the unknown and partly as a wish to feel that you have a kind of elder brother who will stand by you in all your troubles and disputes. Now, do you notice what he's done? He attacks a reason that people believe, fear. Now, is fear the reason you believe? Then he says, then he gives another reason, this elder brother. Well, I suppose Jesus is, and he does stand with us. But he phrases it to make it sound like a pretend friend. So what he's implying is, well, I'm not afraid. I'm a proper grown-up, and I don't need a pretend friend. Christians, you all look silly. Jesus is all made up. But that's not why we believe, is it? It's very common that people assign a reason against Christ that isn't even a reason. It's completely irrelevant. And what this whole passage shows is what the world thinks about God. Often we're told that people are trying to find God. And that's why since the 90s, maybe before, I suppose it's more of a hippie thing before, but since the 90s, across classes, people are seeking God in or religious experience in the New Age and Eastern religions, as well as in cults. And it seems to be a British thing that we have a particular pendant for the exotic, for something that's new to us. But the fact is, people hate God. As God, as he's revealed in Jesus Christ and shown in the Bible. People want to kill God, or if possible, replace him with a tame version. Given half the chance, if Jesus, the God-man, came to Chelmsford and walked around, someone would try to murder him. Well, we find out why that is in other parts of the Bible and how he gets in the way, how he corrects us. But the center of the passage, as always, is Christ. Christ is central. Even when he's not doing or saying very much, he's the center of everything else is going on around. He is fulfilling, among other things, he's fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah, isn't he? Like a sheep goes to the slaughter silently. He hears the accusation and he says virtually nothing. He only speaks when he legally has to. And then he only speaks a minimum amount. He brings no defense. He just says the truth. Look at one of the charges in verse 61. This man said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, earlier in Matthew 24, we looked at before, Jesus said the temple would be destroyed, although he doesn't say he'd do it. In John's gospel, he says that the temple will be destroyed and rebuilt. And then John makes a little editorial comment that he's talking about his own body. So Jesus wasn't threatening vandalism or revolt, but that his body, the temple, his body is the temple, that he is the place where God is present, and that he is the place we meet with God, and that his body would be destroyed only to be raised on the third day. But they've not understood that. And actually, they're serving that purpose, because Jesus is not attacking the temple, but they are. They are going to attack the temple that is his body and destroy it. of course, only because he allows them to, and only for him to take it back on the third day. And when being pushed for an answer about being the Christ in verse 63, he gives this answer in verse 64. You have said so, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And that is the last straw when the accusation of blasphemy comes out. But it's true. What Jesus says is true, isn't it? That the next time they meet him, it will be the risen, glorified Jesus. And that means one of the things we find out about the resurrection, the significance is he's raised as judge. Next time they meet him, it will be the risen, ascended, and returning future Jesus. They'll meet him as their judge. Here they see an ordinary man making outrageous claims, but then they'll see him as he is. To use a modern catchphrase, they'll be standing on the wrong side of history, unless they've changed their mind between. They're on the wrong side of the decision. They're so concerned about maintaining their little status quo and their control that the result is they're going to face Jesus as the judge of all people. Now, at first glance, it looks awful, doesn't it? This injustice, this innocent man, the abuse of power. But we're reminding again, it's not poor, helpless Jesus. The judge, the false witnesses, the mock jury, every one of them is sat there under judgment. As you are picturing the scene, who is the judge in this picture? It's the same with evangelistic preaching. When you're sharing the gospel informally with someone as the opportunity arises in a forum event in Christianity Explored and people are asking questions, which, by the way, is great. You see that in the book of Acts. Answer, get people to ask questions and question the questions is a good thing to do. But the reality is, who is asking the questions? Of who? Who is the one being studied and under scrutiny? Who is the one being judged? And who is the judge? If you've ever been into a courtroom, I've been on jury service before, or if you've ever seen it in a TV room and you see that the judge and the lawyers and the various people that are there to make the court function and the jury and the public gallery, and in front of the judge is the defendant in the dock. But the shock here in this passage is the man in the dock is the prosecution and the judge. And yet he stands there and accepts the accusations. Now, have you ever had that? Have you ever been accused of something that you have not done? It provokes anger in most people, doesn't it? And yet he stands accused, even spat on and hit. Now, if you've ever been spat on and hit, I don't think such a thing has happened to me since school days, but again, it made me angry. A couple of years ago, I was walking the dog, and someone drove past and threw a sandwich at me from the car. And I was pretty angry. And it's interesting hearing Fran praying for my godliness earlier, so perhaps timing is that what made me angry was not a sandwich. The anger was he was in a car. And come here and throw that sandwich at me was the first thing that went through my mind. Had a similar thing on by a court, funny enough. Someone asked me for change, for some money, only for a couple of pounds. And I held the money. I very rarely have change. I held the money out. He took it. And I was standing with a previous church, standing with a church intern called Will, and he said to me, "Well done, Darren. I know you could pick him upside down and shake the money out of him, but well done." And I was thinking, but mentally I am doing that. I am very angry. I'm angry if someone hits me or spits at me. I'm angry if someone accuses me of something that I didn't do, despite all the evidence contrary. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But Jesus is very different. Jesus hears these false accusations. He takes the spitting and the beating and the mocking. And there is no anger. There's no visible anger. There's no commanding of the angels. I mean, I reckon I could turn the guy upside down just about. What could Jesus do with these legions of angels? None of which he uses. Why? Because there will be justice on the last day for those who still do this. But more why is he's going to the cross. That this is deliberate and meaningful on his part. He's going to the cross for you. See, now we see this helpless man on the wrong side of justice going to the cross. But by faith we see a glorified Saviour who's returning to save and to judge, who hands himself over to the cross to save you and to obey his Father's will and to bring glory to him. He's in control at every step of the way. Now, isn't that striking? He is in control and allows these things to be said and done. He is in control as he goes to the high priest. So the high priest, despite what his motives are, is offering God the perfect sacrifice. He didn't even know it. Others mock and beat. All of them are doing Jesus' bidding. And today people still mock Christ. Those who sneer and worse. And if they're going to attack Jesus, they're going to attack his body, the church. And there are concerns that people have about religious freedom here in this land, rightly so. But really, we have it very easy. Globally and historically, we've got it very easy. People in this country a few hundred years ago were burnt for saying the Lord's Prayer in English or having a Bible in English. We've got it pretty easy. Some of our mission partners, they face real mortal danger for some parts of the world. We really have it very easy. Make the most of it. Jesus was sneered at then and he is now. Evidence is ignored then and now. And maybe you're someone here even today who, for whatever reason you're here, you're someone who ignores the evidence, the overwhelming evidence in front of you. What you need evidence for when you've got an opinion. Well, consider who it is that sits in judgment. Who is sitting in judgment over who? Who sits in judgment over whom? When we look at the evidence, we weigh up, what do I think of Jesus? But actually, he's sitting in judgment, what do I think of you? Jesus Christ stands over history, just as he stood over these events. And he's working all these things through to the salvation of his people. And we keep seeing this in the Gospels, don't we? Keep on seeing it in the whole Bible. And it's the same Jesus today. The same sovereign control he has today. Which means not only you really should turn to him, but it means that when we do trust on him, he really does have you. Let's pray. Almighty God, we thank you for your Son, who willingly went to the cross to take the sin that was ours as his own. We thank you that he was in control of all the events, even the moment of his death. Please would you move our hearts to trust in him. We ask in his name. Amen.